Good morning, one and all, whether in Theosophy Hall or on Zoom. Just a couple of housekeeping notes. So during the pandemic and going forward now, it's a very good experience to have Zoom. It's important to recall our declaration. The Philadelphia ULT meetings maintain anonymity, offer no crosstalk or side issues of personal anecdotes, and participants speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. These traditions are designed to welcome all to the study of the philosophy of theosophy without the distractions of any social differentiations or personal attributes. Please let us all work to maintain these declared purposes. Also, just a housekeeping note, if you're not speaking, please mute your microphone. And also, if you're moving around, please go off camera because it can be distracting. Also, we want to mention that we want to thank you all for joining us in an effort to maintain a fragrance-free zone here at Theosophy Hall for the benefit of those with sensitivities. So we'll have further announcements and about our class today, which is on higher and lower mind. But we first want to read our declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and it keeps in view are too absorbing and lofty and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, It's the exemplification and practice of those principles, a true realization of the self, and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. We're getting a little background noise, so we just want to remind you all to mute if necessary, if you can. Thank you, and now we'll have the announcements followed by the first portion of our two-person panel. Thank you.
Good morning. The volunteers who have associated themselves with ULT Philadelphia carry their volunteerism to three meetings per week. As this morning on Sundays, the doors to 1917 Walnut Street, Theosophy Hall, open at 10:30 promptly, and at 11 o'clock, a hybrid meeting, both live in the meeting room at 1917 and also online on Zoom, occurs. During the month of March, our theme is the mysteries of the mind, and there'll be a whole series of presentations on that. Having said that, next Sunday morning, March 19th, is a very special commemorative meeting. It is entitled William Q. Judge Day, Philosopher, Guide, and Friend. It's a celebration, a commemoration, if you will, of the life of William Q. Judge. You can anticipate arriving a little bit early in order to be centered and kind of philosophically meditative. There will be an introductory talk, a biographical talk, followed by a talk on the nature of Judge's service as philosopher, guide, and friend. There will also be a variety of readings by volunteers. So again, that's next Sunday morning. The building opens at 10:30. William Q. Judge Day is celebrated from 11 a.m. until 12. On Wednesdays, the building is open also at 6:15. Everyone is welcome to come into Theosophy Hall at 1917 Walnut Street. The reference materials and a collation of materials are available. The reference library itself is closed for renovation, but the building from 6:15 to 7:15 has ample space for anyone who wishes to do a little preparatory reading of any kind. Promptly at 7:30 on Wednesday nights, a hybrid meeting, Zoom and in-person, occurs. And Wednesday, March 22nd, is another study in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. That class is entitled After Death States, Subjective World, Subjective Heaven World. And we will be on pages 109 to 113 in the Ocean of Theosophy. On Friday evenings, the building is not open, but there is a Zoom session that occurs every Friday at 6:30 promptly, lasting until 7:30, is a more informal roundtable discussion study group, if you will. And we've been reading in the last several weeks a series of articles by B.P. Wadia. This series is entitled Studies in the Voice of the Silence. This coming Wednesday night is March 17th. And at 6:30 promptly, we'll be reading the second half of part four in the series. The title of the particular article is The Virtuous Mind. It's an extremely rich article. The discussion last Friday night was far-reaching, and the discussion in this article may go on not only March 17th, but March 24th. It depends on the depth of the discussion. Now, having said those announcements, a little reminder again, it's a Sunday morning. We are dealing with the monthly theme of the mysteries of the mind. And our title for the panel presentation this morning is The Higher and Lower Mind, a very mysterious subject in itself. And why is that? Well, isn't what it is to be human mysterious in its own sphere? Theosophically speaking, mind is said to emanate from the unknowable. It is an emanation of energy, of ideation, of a universality of mind. And that universality of mind, purusha, if you will, is then evolved across duration of a particular Amen Vajra. And gradually the evolution of that soul, of that mind potentiality, is involved in matter, evolved through spirit, and very gradually in the human state, unfolds beyond the principle of desire to a very rarefied use of mind. But right now, each of us knows we're using finite mind most definitely throughout the course of a day. We know that it's colored by the principle of desire. And yet, each of us in an individualized fashion seeks to know the truth about mind, the nature of mind, the use of mind, the development of mind, the service offered by mind. We're reminded that because of the emanation from the unknowable absolute, the mind principle is one. It may have different aspects or different applications in incarnation, but it is one. And we see the natural array of possibilities of mind in our fellow humans, in ourselves, in the various kingdoms of nature. So one of the mysterious statements is that mind upon incarnation, that communion, that intersection of evolution in which spirit, mind, and physicality merge together in the human state, mind becomes dual in this plane of action that we share. Higher mind is an ideal, a reality, an eternity, an eternal principle. It is an application of the powers and possibilities of mind. The higher mind, each of us can imagine, we can envision, we can aspire to the universality, that spiritual mind that's available to each and all, to every single human being around the globe. And we know we see an array of this principle. We don't see just the original element of pure mind and pure ideation, but we see an array of partial genius, partial lack of genius among our fellow human beings and in ourselves. But we're reminded from the basis of understanding higher mind that in potential, each of us is divine, is spiritual, capable of mastering the psychic or the astral, the physiological, the physical. Mind, it is said, higher mind in particular, that eternal entity is the knower, the perceiver, the thinker, the link between spirit or deity and the personal. It is said that mind is lit by the elder brothers, the perfected ones of infant humanity, and that it is lit on the basis of past incarnations of the collective, just as it is lit in life, in physical incarnations among human beings at the individual level. So, manas, powers, mind, the potential of the immortal working through an incarnation, a personality, a physicality, a body. We know that we can be intuitive in certain ways. We can feel conscience within and discern right from wrong. We know that we can discern harmony of oneness of spirit, the harmony and heartfelt drive, a spiritual instinct to be altruistic, to be of service. We know that we have a creative sense of vision, certainly, a power of imagining and bringing that about into the real world. And we also know that we have that higher aspect where direct cognition, intuition, allows us to tap into a mysterious memory from the past and to have the wisdom to know when and how to act in the moment of a crisis, in the moment of a celebration. We know as thinkers that there's a sense of duty, a sense of dharma. There's a sense of progress, the confidence, the hope, the courage, the dependency on the notion that we can grow, we can progress, we can learn, we can assimilate, we can set up causes, we can reflect on the events of the causes, and we can vow within to do better, to perfect. And so we can arouse intuition, we can arouse universal principles, we can use analogies and correspondences, we can consider the endless possibilities of manifestation. And we also can contemplate in a self-analytical mode, a self-conscious mode, the responsibility of creating thought, creating action on this plane that affects not only our personality, not only those who are in our closer circles, but affects life throughout the manifestation. So, in terms of theosophical terms, you may have heard the concept of buddhi manas, divine intellection, storehouse of wisdom sometimes, heartfelt memory, intuition. And we're reminded that our very use of the creative powers of speech are a manifestation of mind operating from a spiritual point of view, operating as one, perhaps colored by a desire entity, but creating and evolving a magical communication in the moment with our fellows. All of this is said to be a reflection of the most mysterious powers of thought at the cosmic or universal levels. You may have heard the word Kirasakti, that which enables the production of external, perceptible, phenomenal results, inherent energy. And so we have that mysterious power within us to imagine, to refine in terms of morality and ethics, and then produce a manifestation based on that thought. The eternal higher ego, the eternal higher mind, is changeless, is a witness, is an observer, stores all the memories, synthesizes all of the experiences, and works through that sense of I am I. And none of us has a monopoly on this. There's a universality because we have at one the same absolute, unknowable point of origin. All souls are identical with that universal oversoul, compelled by natural law, cooperating in the greatest cycles of evolution, cosmic and individual, impressed by certain eternal verities within our buddhi nature. If only we remain focused in the higher mind, but too often, mysteriously into ourselves, we become sidetracked by something called the lower mind.
Is that my cue?
That's your cue.
So we heard about the higher mind. That's our ideal real selves. But we have the lower mind. The buddhi manas is the higher and the kamma manas is the lower. So we strive for the virtuous mind, which is the class that we're in the midst of on Friday nights. So we're striving for this virtuous mind, the beautiful mind, we could say. But we need to go, there's a path. We're a bridge. It's called the Antaskarana. And so we are, in a sense, to destroy that bridge and put the lower behind, to mount on high, as in the Bhagavad Gita, and to be able to, to mount on high, and in a sense, to destroy that which we are struggling with right now. But we need it. We are literally nailed to the cross of matter when we incarnate. And it's our mission to raise up not only ourselves, but all the lives in the lower kingdoms so that they have a chance to come up to our estate, which we've earned in eons past. And then we go on and we become like the elder brothers or the angels, the Dhyan Chohans, those exalted beings. But we have quite a challenge in front of us. Now, there are emanations from above, but there are also emanations from below. And these emanations can rule us if we like to. If we're, in a sense, if we allow ourselves to be asleep at the wheel and distracted, we're gonna run into a ditch. And then we get into the mire and the muck. We need to clean ourselves off and mount our horse again. We'll use the horse as a metaphor. Grab the reins, which are our emotions, and steer the chariot. And that is, of course, discussed in the Bhagavad Gita. So we have the three qualities of matter, which are sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva being high and pure and holy. Rajas meaning that's activity, but it's also, it can be lower activity. It can be greed. It can be lust. It can be avarice. It can be all of those things which one, if we think that we are ourselves and we are our bodies, and this is all we are, we're a name, we're a job, we're a neighborhood, we're our friends, we're our associations, the clubs we may belong to. If we think that's the real man, then we're really on the road to ruin, as it were, which since we've been incarnating for as male and female after Manus was lit up 18 million years ago, we've fallen into matter and become involved with matter and overwhelmed with it. And many, many are. And theosophy is here as divine wisdom to say, no, we are not that. We are not our bodies. We are not all of those attributes. That's false. That's the false ego. That's the personality. So the first talk on the higher mind, another way to say a higher mind, is the eternal pilgrim or the individuality. It is our true spiritual divine natures because we have that potential in us. We are gods in a sense, but we don't know it. But we're here to learn. We're here to learn and to grow and to give and to share what knowledge we have with those that may know less than us. Believe it or not, they're out there. You know, these theosophical ideas are so daunting And they can be sort of abstruse at times, but they're meant for reflection. They're meant for, you know, it's a challenge. It's really, the ideas in their essence are, they're very challenging. And so we go through trial and error through errors, correcting the mistakes of our past, cleaning up that karma when we allowed ourselves to just live in the senses, live in the five senses. And that kind of life, it's a dead end, really. So we are to raise the self by the self, we are told, meaning we're to raise the lower self by the higher self. So we have a roadmap here in Theosophy, and we are not to, we will fall, we will stumble, but we need to get back on track. And so we need to integrate ourselves. Yoga means union, and that's union between the mind and the heart. And it demands that we become virtuous. So the mind is driven by human feelings and passions, and it roams in the field of the senses. We are cautioned that thou shalt not let thy senses make a playground of thy mind. And it's so easy to do. It takes no thought to do that, really. It may take a little planning, but not much. So only the noble, spiritual, and divine are kept assimilated into that beauty. So the kama manas, kama meaning desire, but actually there's kama buddhi too, because that's the desire that first arose in it, the primal germ of mind. The whole purpose of evolution is really that divine love. Kama can also be divine love and desire for the best for all, for our fellow human beings. So we tend to talk about, you know, the lower karmic desires, but there are also the higher karmic desires as well. So Manas is our tempter and our redeemer, our intelligent liberator, and our savior from pure animalism. HPV asserts that man can and must know self. Now, there's a couple of quotes here. So we'll just end with these two quotes from HPV. Man can and must, to the inquiring theologian, man can and must inquire if he is to be saved. His salvation lies within himself. It is through manas and mind and self-consciousness that he will finally be self-redeemed. And so also HPV asserts that man can and must know self. To the scientist, she says, man can and must know self if he is not to be engulfed in despair. So Theosophy is religion, science, and philosophy. It's all three combined. There's no separation. So There's a message for the scientist and a message for the theologian. And really, ideally, they should be on the same page. So we'll open it up for discussion now, comments and questions for the second half of the class. SL?
The mystery of the mind, especially the lower mind, seems to be that its origin is in the higher. It's not lower by nature. It's essentially the same in its powers and origin as the higher. So why is it called the lower? How did it get to be so low? What powers does it use or have that drags it down?
Well, it's like the snake in the Garden of Eden. It's like Pygmalion looking at his reflection and falling in love with it. We fell in love with this. I mean, matter is very interesting. It's life is, there's so much variety. It's amazing. And it distracts the spirit from the mission. So we need to be reminded time and again. Saviors have been sent to remind whenever there's an increase in vice and it seems like all is going to be lost. There have been saviors from time to time that come to provide another impulse, a message, but it's always, it's not so much follow me as this is the roadmap. So everything is dual. So we need there is a lower mind because we have to raise ourselves up and raise up all creation. Any other comments on that?
Yeah, we could use the analogy of the water cycle, the hydrologic cycle. At the most ethereal element stage, there's hydrogen and oxygen in pure form. They combine, if you will, and form water. And we know that we have one concept of water that transcends gaseous, liquid, and solid state. It transcends, it is one, and then takes on attributes, characteristics, ranging from very, very salty to mildly brackish to pure and lack of salt whatsoever. Mind is similar to that analogy. There is one power that originates in the most abstract, ethereal, universal, cosmic form we can imagine, and then gradually across time has aggregates of traits because the self-conscious thinker begins to work with that principle and begins to color the principle. So from the strengths of using mind for a more finite or terrestrial purpose, we have things like reasoning from logic to conclusion, using motives and emotions by free will and choice, using imagination in a fanciful kind of a way, in a self-centered kind of a way, and creating these choices and tendencies on the use of mind that can make them lower and lower and lower. But in potential, the self-conscious entity, the thinker in the human state, has the right, has the responsibility to purify, to raise the use of mind, to refocus it in, tune into a higher vibration, if you will, and very gradually development, moral discernment and detachment, meditative strengths of concentration, compassion, reminiscence, not just cerebration of lower memory and recollection. All this can be done. But what we designate lower and higher is actually free will and choice of an entity, an eternal entity, choosing where to focus mind, high or low.
We saw a hand, but did SL have a follow-up first or not? Okay, MDW. Are you looking for the mute button or the unmute? Or can we get back to you?
Or I think the host can unmute him.
Can the host unmute? No. Maybe.
Yes, thank you very much. I was lost in space. the fact that we live on this plane, it must be the lower mind that operates here. The higher mind, we would think, cannot, but only the lower mind. So the lower mind is absolutely a necessity for us to get in touch with all of nature. So the idea that, you know, this mind can reach down to the lowest depths of nature, but also can raise up to the highest pinnacle that we can imagine. So our job then is to, how do we bring that higher mind into the lower mind's activities? Is there a certain formula that we must, or that we can use to help us bring the higher mind into our daily life? Question.
Well,
is there a formula? Each of us as eternal beings has the possibility to look at our own character development, to be introspective, to be self-conscious and aware of tendencies, both for strengths and weaknesses. And therefore, each of us can create a rendition of a spiritual path that is all-encompassing. We can design a way of living and thinking that suits this incarnation so we can bloom where we're planted. And that might look like setting up fixed times for meditation, morning and evening. It might look like developing anchor statements or mantras, little triggers that we could use 24/7 to bring mind back to a spiritual focus, back to a point of calmness and concentration. And with those practices affiliated with reading multiple scriptures, multiple high forms of literature in which ethics and morality are explained and described. As we begin to try to take that knowledge from books and classes into our ability to be self-aware and our ability to count to 10 in any stance before we take action, we begin to develop new traits of concentration, new traits of ethical development, and we begin to open up channels within the astral body, within the astral brain, the physical brain, so that in periods of pure meditation, in periods of deep sleep, when we have the potentiality of being as Buddhi monastic as we can at this plane, we can begin to bring some of that wisdom, some of that illumination into the role of the daily mind that we use in this particular plane.
Is there a follow-up to that, MDW?
Yes. So the practical application of what was just said, is that what is outlined in the Bhagavad Gita?
Well, it's in all our really great devotional books that we read, and the Bhagavad Gita, the Voice of the Silence, par excellence, the Dhammapada, Light on the Path, and others. There's, you know, it's Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. There's many formulas that work, but they need to be applied. And so we need to figure out what works for us mm-hmm. and apply it. We really do. We need to apply, we're told. It's work.
It's work, but it's also optimistic and confidence inspiring, because we know that we have the ability to sense I am pure existence. We know that. We also have the ability to watch what we're saying, what we're thinking, what we're feeling, what our trigger responses are to external stimuli. And as we age and mature, we become more and more aware of certain tendencies. Some of us take in information kinesthetically by being very active. Some of us take in information by hearing, others by sight, some by a blend of those. And so as we become more aware of personal traits, we become more aware of how to use them as bridges, how to build a progression, if you will, from where we are to where we can envision a true soul, a true soul in a true human state might be of service to others.
We would just like to paraphrase a quote from Isis Unveiled. Mankind has always been convinced of the existence of a personal spiritual entity within the personal physical man. The closer we get to this Christos or the Christ principle, the closer the union, the more serene is man's destiny, and the less dangerous the external conditions. And we have a hand in Theosophy Hall.
Yes. to make it a very practical situation, when we're trying to figure out how can we access that higher mind, we can. There's a couple things that we thought of, and was we've heard in the meetings about finding the sacred in the mundane, that trying to, no matter what you're doing, if it's just cleaning or cooking or whatever, try and to bring that sacredness into that action. The reason why you're doing it, and thinking about like preparing food, how the food came from the field to the table. And then there's also that idea of a lifetime's meditation, trying to figure out a higher purpose for yourself. And it could be something very simple. So there's a couple very practical actions that we can do.
Well, we've read that the mother pig suckling her piglets can be poetry. We can see poetry in the piglets. Or we can see the dirt and the muck. It's what we focus on. It's there's poetry and beauty all around us. It's just a matter of looking for it, the sacred and the mundane. SL?
Previously, sleep was mentioned. So when the brain is, quote, asleep, is the lower mind asleep? And if it is, who or what is it that is conscious and aware and experiencing dreams?
Well, it's the observer. It's the higher mind. The lower is asleep during dreams, where the criminal and the saint commune on the highest planes, because we all are one. So it's the higher mind, we think. What does JCS think?
In the deepest stages of sleep, we have a scenario that is a spiritual existence. And so the soulful mind, the heart and the soul, the heart and the mind together is blended in a particular subjective state. It's at one. But we also know that there is a dreaming state, transitional states, both when we're falling asleep and when the physical is beginning to wake up. And in those transitional states, very gradually what happens is as mind, pure consciousness, soulful consciousness begins to transition back into incarnation, we pick up the psychic, the emotional, the aspects of the lower mind, and they can color the dreams that we may have had in that deep sleep state. So what is true and wise and inspirational in the deepest sleep states can begin to pick up muck and mire from the lower transitory terrestrial existence, and like pure water, can become more and more brackish or salty or bittersweet, depending on the analogy you want to use, in those transitioning states back to consciousness, working through physicality.
Yes, go ahead, SL.
Follow up, please. So as we're moving through those dream states, waking dream states, if our mind is aware of contrast, if it's beginning to make choices, then the lower mind actually is awakening at that point. And it may waken before we get out of bed or open our eyes. In other words, the lower mind is of the nature of perceiving opposites, being aware and making choices and reasoning it. And we do know that goes on in dreams to a certain extent.
Yeah, the finite use of mind depends on sensation, depends on reasoning from premise to conclusion, and has to do with the interaction of the external experience with that internal. And so that is lower, if you will. If we see contrast, if it becomes objective in a particular way, we know that we're watching that cerebration process, that lower mind, that monkey mind. There was a chat.
Yes, we see the chat. Do you want us to read it? Or do you want to
read it? Here it is. Does Theosophy teach that we have a subconscious mind like modern psychology teaches? We know that Theosophy uses the word ego, E-G-O, having to do with that higher mind, that permanent entity, not the highest aspect of Buddhi man, but a slightly rarefied version, a more particularized version of that. And that's to be contrasted with ego, no capital letter, E-G-O, that you often read about, especially among Freudian psychoanalysts. In terms of the psychologists today, many, many, many have been studying Eastern psychology as it's presented in the Gita. There is a notion of cognitive behavioral therapy in which an introspective thinker can observe experiences, re-educate themselves, and then elevate themselves. So that's a possibility. But it's focused on the particular incarnation, that particular psychology of that particular personality. Does my co-panelist have a different view?
No, not a different view, but just so Freud and then later Jung and others that picked up on his ideas, they're writing a generation after HPB, basically around the turn of the 20th century. And so they came up with their own terms, which are often at variance with the theosophical principles. And at that time, there was no psychology in the West worthy of that name. The first American psychologist, we believe, is considered to be William James, who wrote Varieties of Religious Experience. And he was, you know, a very thoughtful individual. But yeah, the ego is the personality, which would be the lower mind. And the ego is that the eternal pilgrim, the divine self. So they're really opposites. So it's very confusing when we come with this Western perspective of Freudian psychology and start studying theosophy, because they took the term for whatever reason, and it's different. It's very different.
What is often recommended is a reading of the work of Abraham Maslow. Maslow developed a sense of the hierarchy of needs. And in that pyramid of development, of evolution, you can see the basis of the animal man, if you will, human animal instinct for survival in a very simplistic manner, low on this pyramid. And then gradually, as each of these different needs is met, very gradually emerges the possibility of a self-actualizing human being. In other words, those souls which are eventually able to use all of their powers of thought in order to bloom self-consciously, creatively, as artistic and scientific thinkers. So it's Abraham Maslow's work that may someday bridge the gap, probably, between pure theosophy and the babyhood of Western psychology.
And of course, today there are the teachings of theosophy and various other teachings from the Orient have you know, permeated the culture, and it's good. It's been a lot of good has come out of it, and a lot of rethinking of the very materialistic aspects of early Western psychology. Mm-hmm.
Yes, as the original seed ideas were planted in the late 1800s by Blavatsky and Judge, those seed ideas are now sprouting in a variety of different ways, in a variety of different fields, from physics and chemistry and astronomy, all the way over to the arts. And so everything in between is available. And it's all an opportunity for each one of us to step beyond knowledge. It's not enough to blindly read or experience or observe these blooming sprouts. Rather, we have to gradually develop the power of discernment to understand which one is a weed and which is poisonous, and which one of these sprouts is actually true and pure to the common good and the eternal verities that Blavatsky and Judge were bringing to the Western world.
Yes, and therein lies the rub. SL.
Well, we certainly notice in young children an exercise of mind and reason and feeling and imagination. But something different begins to happen with the mind around the age of 7. What is that, and how does it relate to this subject of higher and lower mind?
It is said in the philosophy that on average, around seven, what happens is that that eternal pilgrim, that monastic entity, is fully stepping into the role of the incarnation at hand. What does that mean? There is a recapitulation of the lighting up of Manus. Around seven, give or take, depending on the individual soul, we begin to see the development of a morality, a degree of conscience, a degree of awareness of what is fair, what is not fair, what makes sense in terms of universality, and when selfishness has perverted universality. And it's at that age of conscience, it is said, that the soul using that particular incarnation begins to exercise free will and choice, begins to gather knowledge and experience, begins to sense motive, and then in that free will and choice begins to generate karma. Up until that point, it is said, the soul using the baby human being from birth to about seven is more like the animal state, where desire, mobility, lack of self-consciousness is exhibited, and therefore there's no karma generated.
It's also called the age of reason by various churches, because the child begins to reason, to really use their reason and not just react to things, but start to really examine and question. And then that old soul that's there starts to exhibit itself. SL?
Well, before the term was used, there's a bridge between the higher and the lower. And of course, for there to be the full incarnation of higher Manus, well, we would have a great being on this plane at that point. So we were wondering at that age seven or around there about, is that when that bridge, we might say, is formed enough where the higher can link itself and begin to influence the lower mind?
We would think so.
Yeah. There's a wonderful quote from Mr. Crosby, who was the consummate student of theosophy. And it has to do with pondering, using our mental faculties, because where we are in evolution right now as soul, we have this full range of mind powers, from the most materialistic that we can envision to the loftiest altruistic, abstract powers that we can imagine. And he wrote this: the doctrine of the I is a brain consciousness largely composed of external impressions. The doctrine of the heart is of the spiritual consciousness of the ego, not perceived by the brain. Consciousness until right thought and right action blooms and attunes certain centers in the brain to accord with spiritual vibration. So much of this endeavor is an effort to imagine pure yoga, creating harmony between the two halves of the physical brain, between the I doctrine and the heart doctrine, and beginning to assimilate or integrate them back into the fullness of the oneness that should be, that once was.
Well, we only have 1 minute left. Is there any quick comment? Yes, go ahead, SL.
Well, perhaps this is meant to anticipate our meeting next Sunday. But Mr. Judge has been called the Antaskarana, or the bridge between the Western and Eastern mind. So apparently that lower mind can be influenced or has certain cultural mental qualities of its own, which allows for differences in the way groups of people perceive the same things, the same experience on the earth.
Yes, it's a bridge. It's a two-way bridge. And we are to eventually not need the bridge, though. The bridge is the path. So on the other side, the bridge is destroyed.
Well, we can also see the little screensaver today with a heart leading the physical brain.
Yes.
And therein, in that twofold hand-holding, is the bridge.
It is. It certainly is. And the heart and the mind, the heart and the brain are two organs that are above the others. All the other organs have to do with the physical functions primarily. But yes, the heart should lead the brain. Absolutely. So we thank all for listening and participating. And we need to adjourn at this time. Thank you.